before. Those eyes told me that no matter what happened, he was going to pursue it to the very end. If you don't understand something, then stick with it until you do. That seemed to be Manshiki's basic approach to life. Okay, I said. Tomorrow I'll get in touch with Masahiko. And I'll contact the landscape designer, Manshiki said. He paused. By the way, there's one thing I wanted to ask you. Yes? Do you often have these kinds of, what should I say, paranormal experiences? No, I said. This is a first. I'm a very ordinary person who's lived a very ordinary life. That's why I find it all so confusing. What about you, Mr. Manshiki? A faint smile rose to his lips. I've had many strange experiences. I've seen things common sense can't explain, but something this strange is a first. After this, we sat there in silence, listening to the ringing of the bell. As always, the bell stopped completely a little after 2:30, and the mountains were again blasted with the buzz of insects. I'd best be going, Manshiki said. Thank you for the whiskey. I'll get in touch soon. Under the moonlight, Manshiki got into his glossy silver Jaguar and drove off. He gave a short wave out the open window, and I waved back. After the sound of his engine had faded away down the slope, I remembered that he'd had a glass of whiskey, the second glass he hadn't touched, but his face hadn't turned red at all. His speech and attitude no different than if he'd drunk water. He must be able to hold his liquor. And he wasn't driving far. It was a road that only local residents used, and at this hour there wouldn't be any cars coming the other direction, or any pedestrians. I went back inside, rinsed out our glasses in the kitchen sink, and went to bed. I thought about people coming with heavy equipment to move the stones behind the little shrine and digging a hole. It was hard to picture it as real. Before that happened, I needed to read the Ueda Akinari story he'd mentioned, Fate Over Two Generations. But I'd leave everything for tomorrow. Things would look different in the light of day. I switched off the bedside light, and to the background noise of buzzing insects, I fell asleep. At 10 a.m., I called Masahiko Amada's office and explained the situation. I didn't bring up Ueda Akinari, but told him how I'd had an acquaintance over to make sure that bell ringing in the middle of the night wasn't just an auditory illusion I was having. That is really creepy, Masahiko said. But do you really believe there's someone underneath those stones ringing a bell? I don't know. But I can't just ignore it. I hear it every single night. What will you do if, when you dig it all up, something weird emerges? What do you mean, something weird? I don't know, he said. Some mysterious thing that's best left alone. You should come at night sometime and hear that sound. If you heard it yourself, you'd understand why I can't just let it be. Masahiko sighed deeply on the other end of the line. No, thanks, he said. I'll pass. I've always been a bit of a coward. I hate scary stories, anything frightening. No, thanks. I'll leave it all up to you. It's not going to bother anyone if you move those old stones and dig a hole. Do whatever you like. Just make sure not to unearth anything weird, okay? I don't know how it's going to turn out, but once I know, I'll be in touch. If it were me, I'd just wear earplugs, Masahiko said. After I hung up, I sat in a chair in the living room and read the Ueda Akinari story. I read it first in the original classical Japanese, then in the contemporary language version. A couple of details were different, but as Manshiki had said, there was a strong resemblance between the story and what I was experiencing here. In the story, the character heard the gong sounding at 2 o'clock in the morning, about the same time. but what I heard wasn't a gong, but a bell. In the story, the buzz of insects didn't stop. The protagonist hears the gong mixed in with the sound of the insects. But these small details aside, what I experienced was exactly the same as in the story. It left me dumbfounded, in fact, at how close the two were. The unearthed mummy was completely dried up, just its hand doggedly moving, striking the gong. A terrifying vitality made the hand move almost mechanically. No doubt this priest gave up the ghost while reciting sutras and beating out a rhythm on the gong. The main character put clothes on the mummy and poured water on his lips. Before long, he was able to eat some thin rice gruel and gradually put on flesh. Finally, he recovered to the point where he looked like a normal human being. But you got no sense from him at all of a priest who had attained enlightenment, no intelligence or wisdom, and not a hint of dignity. And he had lost all memory of his former life. He couldn't recall even why he'd gone underground like that for so very long. He ate meat now and had a considerable sexual appetite. He got married and managed to make a living doing menial work. People nicknamed him Nyujo no Josuka, Josuka, the meditation guy. His pathetic figure made the villagers lose all respect for Buddhism. Is this the kind of wreck you end up as, they wondered, after all the strict ascetic training he went through, risking his life in pursuit of Buddhism? They started to despise faith and stopped going to temple. That was Ueda's story. As Menshiki had said, the story reflected the author's cynical worldview. It's not merely some tale of the supernatural. For all that, Buddhist teachings were in vain. That man must have been underground, ringing that gong for well over 100 years, yet nothing miraculous came of it, and people were fed up that all that came from it were bones. I reread the short story, Fate Over Two Generations, several times, and found myself utterly confused. Say we used heavy equipment to move the stones, dug up the soil, and what emerged was a bony, pathetic mummy. Then how was I supposed to handle that? Would I be responsible for resuscitating him? Was it wiser, as Masahiko had advised, to not meddle and simply plug up my ears and leave it all alone? But even if I wanted to do that, I couldn't simply make it go away. I would never be able to escape that sound, no matter how tightly I plugged up my ears. And say I moved somewhere else, that sound might follow me. Plus, like Menshiki, I was curious. I had to find out what lay hidden beneath those stones. In the afternoon, Menshiki called me. Did you get Mr. Amada's permission? I told him pretty much everything about my conversation with Masahiko, and how he'd told me to handle it any way I wanted. I'm glad, Menshiki said. I've arranged things with the landscape designer. I didn't tell him about the mysterious sound. I just asked him to move some stones out in the woods and then dig a hole there. It was a sudden request, but his schedule happened to be free. So if you don't mind, he'd like to come and look over the site this afternoon and start work tomorrow morning. Is it all right with you that he comes to check out the work site? He can come over whenever he wants, I said. After he inspects the site, he'll arrange for the equipment he needs. The work itself should be done in a few hours. I'll be present when they're working, Menshiki said. I'll be there too. When you find out what time they'll start, let me know, I said. By the way, I added, remembering, about what we were talking about last night. Before we heard that sound, Menshiki didn't seem to follow. I'm sorry, you mean... It was about the 13-year-old girl, Maria. You said she might be your real daughter. We were talking about her when we heard the bell, and that's as far as we got.
Ah, yes, said Menshiki.
Now that you mention it, we did talk about that. I'd totally forgotten. Yes, we should talk about that again sometime. But there's no rush. We can talk about it again once we take care of the matter at hand. After that, I couldn't concentrate. I tried reading, listening to music, cooking, but all I could think of was what lay beneath those ancient stones in the woods. I couldn't shake the thought of a blackened mummy, shriveled up like a dried fish. Chapter 15. This is only the beginning. Menshiki called me that night to let me know that the work would begin the next morning, Wednesday, at 10. Wednesday morning it was drizzling off and on, but not hard enough to delay the work. It was a fine rain, and a hat or raincoat with a hood was enough. No need for an umbrella. Menshiki had on an olive-green rain hat, the kind the British might use for duck hunting. The leaves of the trees, starting to turn fall colors, took on a dull color from the nearly invisible rain that soaked them. The workers used a flatbed truck to move in a small backhoe, a very compact piece of equipment with a tight turning radius, made to work in confined spaces. There were four workers altogether, one backhoe operator, one foreman, and two additional workers. The shovel operator and the foreman drove the truck. They all had on matching blue rainwear, jackets and trousers, and muddy, thick-soled work boots, and wore protective helmets made of heavy-duty plastic. Menshiki and the foreman were apparently acquainted, and they talked for a while, the two of them beaming next to the little shrine. I could tell, though, that the foreman remained on his best behavior toward Menshiki. Menshiki must have had a lot of clout to arrange for this many people and equipment in such a short time. I watched this whole process half impressed, half bewildered. I had a slight sense of resignation, too, as if everything were already out of my hands. Like when I was a child, and the little kids would be playing some game, and bigger kids would come around and take over. I remembered that feeling. They started the operation by using shovels and some material and boards to create a flat foothold for the backhoe to move, and then they began to actually remove the stones. The backhoe soon trampled down the thicket of pampas grass surrounding the mound. Menshiki and I stood to one side, watching, as they lifted the stones from the mound one by one and moved them to a spot a little ways away. There wasn't anything special about the operation. Probably the same sort of operation that takes place every day all around the world. The workers looked ordinary too, like they were matter-of-factly following procedures they'd done 1,000 times. Occasionally the backhoe operator would stop and call out in a loud voice to the foreman, but it didn't seem like there was any problem. They just exchanged a few words, and he didn't switch off the engine. But I couldn't calmly watch the operation. Each time one of the square stones was removed, my anxiety only deepened. It was like some dark secret that I'd hidden away for years was being revealed, layer by layer, by the powerful, insistent tip of that machine. The problem lay in the fact that even I didn't know what secret I was hiding. Several times I felt I had to get them to stop the operation. Bringing in some large machinery like this backhoe couldn't be the solution. As Masahiko had told me on the phone, all mysterious things should be left buried. I was seized by the urge to grab Menshiki's arm and shout, "Let's stop this! Put the stones back where they were!" But of course, I couldn't do that. The decision had been made and the work begun. Several other people were already involved. A not insubstantial sum of money was changing hands. The amount was unclear, but I assumed Menshiki was footing the bill. We couldn't just stop at this point. The work continued, beyond my will. As if he knew what I was going through, At a certain point, Manshiki came over beside me and lightly patted me on the shoulder. "There's nothing to worry about," he said in a calm voice. "It's going smoothly. It'll all be finished soon." I nodded in silence. Before noon, all the stones had been moved. The ancient stones that had been piled in a jumble in a crumbling mound were now piled up in a neat, official-looking pyramid a little ways away. The fine drizzle silently fell on the pile. Even after removing all those stones, though, the ground hadn't appeared. Below the stones lay more stone. These stones were flat and had been methodically laid out there like a square stone flooring. The whole thing was about 6 feet on each side. "I wonder why it's like that," the foreman said after coming over to where Manshiki was. "I was sure that the stones were just piled up on top of the ground, but they weren't. There seems to be an open space underneath that stone slab. I inserted a thin metal rod into a gap, and it went down pretty far. Not sure yet how deep it goes, though." Manshiki and I gingerly tried standing on top of the freshly uncovered slab. The stones were darkly wet and slippery in spots. Though they'd been artificially cut and evened up over time, the edges had become more rounded off, with gaps between the stones. The nightly sound of the bell must have filtered out through those gaps, and air could probably get in through those too. I crouched down and stared through a gap inside, but it was pitch black, and I couldn't make out a thing. "Maybe they used flagstones to cover up an ancient well. Though for a well, its diameter is a bit big," the foreman said. "Can you remove these flagstones?" Manshiki asked. The foreman shrugged. "I'm not sure. We hadn't planned on this. It'll make things a little complicated, but I think we can manage it. Using a crane would be our best bet, but we'd never get one in here. Each stone doesn't look that heavy, and there's a gap between them. So with a little ingenuity, I think we can manage with the backhoe. We're coming up on our lunch break, so I'll work out a good plan then, and we'll get to work in the afternoon." Manshiki and I went back to the house and had a light lunch. In the kitchen, I threw together some simple ham, lettuce, and pickle sandwiches, and we went out on the terrace to eat as we watched the rain. "This whole operation is delaying what we should be working on, finishing the portrait," I said. Manshiki shook his head. "There's no rush with the portrait. Our first priority is solving this weird matter. Then you can get back to work on the painting." Did this man seriously want his portrait painted? I couldn't help but wonder. This doubt had been smoldering in a corner of my mind from the very start. Did he seriously want me to paint his portrait? Wasn't he just using the portrait as a mere pretext and had some other reason for getting to know me? But what could it be? I couldn't figure it out. Was his goal unearthing what was under those stones? This didn't make sense. He hadn't known about them. That was something unforeseen that only came up after we started on the portrait. Still, he seemed overly enthusiastic about digging them up. And he was shelling out quite a bit of money for the operation, even though it had nothing to do with him. As I was mulling over all this, Manshiki asked, "Did you read the story, Fate Over Two Generations?" "I did," I told him. "What did you think?" "A very strange tale, isn't it?" he said. "It certainly is," I said. Manshiki looked at me for a while, then said, "To tell the truth, that story has tugged at me for a long time. It's one of the reasons this discovery has aroused my interest." I took a sip of coffee and wiped my mouth with a paper napkin. Two crows, cawing at each other, winged their way across the valley, undeterred by the rain. Wet by the rain, their wings would only grow a deeper black. "I don't know much about Buddhism," I said to Manshiki, so I don't understand all the details. But doesn't a priest doing a voluntary burial, this Nyujo, mean he chooses to go into a coffin and die? Exactly. Nyujo originally means attaining enlightenment. So they have the term Iki Nyujo, living Nyujo, to distinguish the two. They make a stone-lined underground chamber and insert a bamboo pipe to allow in air. Before a priest does Nyujo, he maintains a fruitarian diet for a set time, so his body won't putrefy, but will become nicely mummified. Fruitarian? Just eating grasses and nuts and berries. They eat no cooked foods whatsoever, starting with grains. In other words, a radical elimination of all fats and moisture from the body, changing the makeup of the body so it can easily mummify. And after purifying his body, the priest goes underground. In the darkness there, the priest fasts and recites sutras, hitting a gong in time to that, or ringing a bell. And people can hear the sound of that gong or bell through the vent hole. But at some point, the sounds stop. That's the sign that he's breathed his last. And over a period of time, the body gradually turns into a mummy. The custom is to unearth the body after 3 years and 3 months. Why would they do that? So the priests could practice austerity to the point of becoming self-mummified. Doing that allows them to reach enlightenment and to arrive at a realm beyond life and death. This also connects up with mankind's salvation, so-called nirvana. The unearthed enlightened monk, the mummy, is kept at a temple, and through praying to it, people are saved. In reality, it's a kind of suicide. Menshiki nodded. Which is why in the Meiji period the practice of self-burial was outlawed. People who helped in the process could be arrested for aiding and abetting suicide. The truth is, though, priests continued to follow the practice in secret. That's why there may be quite a few cases of priests being buried, but never unearthed by anyone. Are you thinking that stone mound is the remains of a secret burial of that kind? Menshiki shook his head. We won't know until we actually remove the stones, but it's possible. There's no bamboo tube there, but the way it's constructed, air could get in through the gaps, and you can hear sounds from inside too. And you're saying that someone is still alive underneath those stones and is ringing a gong or a bell every night? Menshiki shook his head again. That obviously doesn't make any sense. Reaching nirvana, is that different from merely dying? It is. I'm not all that familiar with Buddhist doctrine, but as far as I understand, nirvana is found beyond life and death. You could see it as the idea that even if the flesh dies and disappears, the soul goes over to a place beyond life and death. Worldly flesh is nothing more than a temporary dwelling. Even if a priest were, through burial alive, to reach nirvana, is it possible for him to rejoin his physical body? Menshiki said nothing and looked at me for a while. He took a bite of his ham sandwich and a sip of coffee. What you're saying is, I didn't hear that sound until 4 or 5 days ago. I said. I'm certain of that. If the sound had been there, I would have noticed. Even if it was small, it's not the kind of sound I would have missed. I only started hearing it a few days ago. What I mean is, even if there's somebody underneath those stones, that person hasn't been ringing the bell for a long time. Menshiki returned his coffee cup to the saucer and studied the pattern on the cup. Have you seen a real mummified priest? He finally said. I shook my head. I've seen several. When I was young, I traveled around Yamagata Prefecture on my own and saw a few that were preserved in temples there. For some reason, there are a lot of these mummified priests in the Tohoku region, especially in Yamagata. Honestly, they're not very nice to look at. Maybe it's my lack of faith, but I didn't feel very grateful when I saw them. Small, brown, all shriveled up. I probably shouldn't say this, but the color and texture reminded me of beef jerky. The physical body really is nothing more than a fleeting, empty abode. That, at least, is what these mummies teach us. We may do our utmost, but at best, we end up as no more than beef jerky. He picked up the ham sandwich he'd been eating and gazed at it intently for a moment, as if he were seeing a ham sandwich for the first time in his life. He went on. At any rate, let's wait till after lunch for them to move those stones. Then we'll know more, whether we want to or not. We went back to the site in the woods just after 1:15. The crew had finished lunch and were hard at work. The two workmen put wedge-like metal implements in the gaps between the stones, and the backhoe used a rope to pull those and raise the stones. The workmen then attached ropes to the dug-up stones, and the shovel hauled these up. It was time-consuming, but one by one, the stones were steadily unearthed and moved off to the side. Menshiki and the foreman were deep in conversation about something for a while, but then he came back to join me.
As they thought, the stones aren't all that thick. Looks like they'll be able to remove them, he explained. There seems to be a lattice-shaped lid underneath all the stones. They don't know what it's made of, but that lid supported the stones. After they remove all the stones on top, they'll need to take off that lid. They don't know yet if they can. It's impossible to guess what lies beneath that. It'll take a while for them to remove all the stones, and once they've made more progress, they'll call us. So they said they'd like us to wait in the house. If you don't mind, let's do that. Standing around here isn't going to help.
We walked back home. I should have used the extra time to continue work on the portrait, but I didn't feel I'd be able to concentrate on painting. The operation out in the woods had me on edge. The 6-foot square stone flooring that had emerged from underneath the mound of crumbling old stones, the solid lattice lid, and the space that seemed to lie below it. I couldn't erase these images from my mind. Menshiki was right. Until we settled this matter, we wouldn't be able to move forward on anything else.
Do you mind if I listen to music while we wait? Menshiki asked.
Not at all, I said. Play whatever record you'd like. I'll be in the kitchen preparing some food. He chose a recording of Mozart, a sonata for piano and violin. The Tannoy autograph speakers weren't very showy, but gave out a deep, steady sound. The perfect speakers for classical music, especially for listening to vinyl records of chamber music. As you might expect of old speakers, they were well suited to a vacuum tube amp. The pianist was Georg Zell, the violinist Raphael Druyan. Menshiki sat on the sofa, eyes closed, and gave himself over to the music. I listened to it from a little ways off, making tomato sauce. I'd bought a lot of tomatoes and had some left over and wanted to make some sauce before they went bad. I boiled water in a large pan, parboiled the tomatoes and removed the skins, cut them with a knife, removed the seeds, crushed them, put them in a large skillet, added garlic, and simmered it all with olive oil, let it cook well. I carefully removed any scum on the surface. Back when I was married, I often made sauce like this. It takes time and effort, but basically it's an easy process. While my wife was at work, I'd stand alone in the kitchen, listening to music on a CD while I made it. I liked to cook while listening to old jazz. Thelonious Monk was a particular favorite. Monk's music was my favorite of his albums. Coleman Hawkins and John Coltrane played on it with amazing solos. but I have to admit that making sauce while listening to Mozart's chamber music wasn't bad either. It was only a short while ago that I'd been cooking tomato sauce in the afternoon while enjoying Monk's unique offbeat melodies and chords. It was only half a year ago that my wife and I had dissolved our marriage, but it felt like something that had taken place ages ago. A trivial historical episode a generation ago that only a handful of people still remembered. I suddenly wondered how my wife was. Was she living with another man now? Or was she still living by herself in that apartment in Hiro? Either way, at this time of day, she would be at work at the architectural firm. For her, how much of a difference was there between her life when I was there and her life now without me? And how much interest did she have in that difference? I was sort of half thinking about all this. Did she have the same feeling that our days spent together seemed like something from the distant past? The record was over, the needle making a popping sound as it spun in the final groove, and when I went to the living room, I found Menshiki asleep on the sofa, arms folded, leaning over slightly to one side. I lifted the needle up from the spinning disc and switched off the turntable. Even when the steady click of the needle stopped, Menshiki continued to sleep. He must have been very tired. He was faintly snoring. I left him where he was. I returned to the kitchen, shut off the gas under the skillet, and drank a big glass of water. I still had time on my hands, so I began to fry some onions. When the phone rang, Menshiki was already awake. He was in the bathroom, washing his face with soap and gargling. The call was from the foreman at the worksite, so I handed the phone to Menshiki. He said a few words, and then said that we would be right over. He handed the phone back.
"They're almost done," he said.
Outside, it had stopped raining. Clouds still covered the sky, but it was lighter out now. The weather seemed to be steadily improving. We hurried up the steps and through the woods. Behind the little shrine, the four men were standing around a hole, staring down into it. The backhoe's engine was off. Nothing was moving. The woods strangely hushed. The stones had been neatly removed, exposing the hole below. The square lattice lid had been taken off too and laid to one side. It was a thick, heavy-looking wooden cover, old but not rotted at all. After that, the circular stone-lined room below was visible. It was under 6 feet in diameter, about 8 feet deep, and was enclosed by a stone wall. The floor seemed to be dirt. Not a single blade of grass grew there. The stone room was completely empty. No one there calling for help. No beef jerky mummy, just a bell-like object lying on the ground. Actually, less like a bell than some ancient musical instrument with a stack of tiny cymbals. A wooden handle was attached, about 6 inches long. The foreman shone a floodlight down on it.
"Was this all that was in there?"
Menshiki asked him.
"Yes, that's it," the foreman said. "Like you asked, we left it just as we found it, after we took off the stones and lid. We haven't touched a thing."
"That's strange," Menshiki said as if to himself. "So there really wasn't anything else at all?"
"I called you right after we lifted off the lid. I haven't been down inside. This is exactly the way it was when we uncovered it," the foreman said.
"Of course,"
Menshiki said in a dry voice.
"It might have been a well originally," the foreman said. "It looks like it was filled in, leaving the hole, but it's too wide for a well, and the stone wall around it is so elaborately constructed. It couldn't have been easy to build. I suppose they must have had some important purpose in mind to construct something that took this much time and effort."
"Can I go down and check it out?"
Menshiki asked the foreman. The foreman was a little unsure. With a hard face, he said, I think I should go down first, just in case. If it's all clear, then you can climb on down. Does that sound good?
Of course, Manshiki said. Let's do that.
One of the workmen brought over a folding metal ladder from the truck, opened it up, and lowered it down. The foreman put on his safety helmet and climbed down the 8 feet to the dirt floor. He looked around him for a while. He gazed up, then shone his flashlight on the stone wall in the floor, closely checking everything. He carefully observed the bell-like object that lay on the dirt floor. He didn't touch it, though, just observed it. He rubbed the soles of his work boots a few times against the dirt floor, kicking his heel against it. He took a few deep breaths, smelling the air. He was only in the hole for about 5 or 6 minutes, then slowly clambered up the ladder to ground level.
It doesn't seem dangerous. The air is good, and there aren't any weird bugs or anything, and the footing is solid. You can go down now if you'd like, he said.
Manshiki removed his rainwear to make it easier to move around, and in his flannel shirt and chinos, he hung his flashlight by a strap around his neck and climbed down the metal ladder. We watched in silence as he descended. The foreman shone the floodlight below Manshiki's feet. Manshiki stood still at the bottom of the hole for a while, waiting, then reached out and touched the stone wall and crouched down to check out what the dirt floor felt like. He picked up the bell-like object on the ground, shone his flashlight on it, and gazed at it. Then he shook it a few times. When he did, it was unmistakably the same bell sound I'd heard. No doubt about it. In the middle of the night, someone had been ringing it here. But that someone was no longer here. Only the bell was left behind. As he studied the bell, Manshiki shook his head a few times, evidently puzzled. Then he carefully studied the surrounding wall again, as if looking for a secret entrance and exit, but he found nothing of the sort. He looked up at us at ground level. He seemed totally confused. He stepped onto the ladder and held out the bell toward me. I bent over and took it from him. A dampness penetrated deep into the ancient wooden handle. As Manshiki had done, I tried shaking it a few times. It sounded louder and clearer than I'd expected. I didn't know what it was made of, but the metal portion wasn't damaged at all. It was dirty, for sure, but not at all rusted. I couldn't figure out how it had remained rust-free, despite being underground in damp soil for years.
What is that? The foreman asked me.
He was in his mid-40s, short but with a sturdy build, suntanned with a bit of stubble on his face.
I'm not sure. Maybe some kind of Buddhist implement or something, I said. Whatever it is, it's certainly from ancient times. Is this what you were looking for? He asked.
I shook my head.
No, we were expecting something else. At any rate, it's a strange place, the foreman said. I can't explain it, but there's a mysterious feeling about it. Who would make this kind of place, I wonder, and why? This was a long time ago, and it must have been quite a task to haul the stones all the way up the mountain and stack them up.
I didn't say anything. Manshiki finally climbed up out of the hole. He called the foreman over to his side, and they talked for a long time. I stood there, bell in hand, next to the hole. I pondered climbing down into this stone-lined chamber, but then thought better of it. I wasn't as hesitant as Masahiko, but I did decide it was better not to do anything uncalled for. If things could be left alone, the smart thing might be to do so. I placed the bell, for the time being, in front of the little shrine, and wiped my palm on my pants a couple of times. Manshiki ambled over.
We'll have them do a more thorough examination of that stone-lined chamber, he said. At first glance, it looks like just a hole, but I'll have them check it all out from one end to the other. They might discover something, though I sort of doubt it. He looked at the bell I'd placed in front of the shrine. It's odd that this bell's the only thing left. Since someone had to be inside there in the middle of the night, ringing the bell. Maybe the bell was ringing by itself, I ventured. Menshiki smiled. An interesting theory, but I doubt it. For whatever purpose, someone was sending out a message from down inside that hole. A message to you, or maybe to us, or to people in general. But whoever it was has vanished like smoke, or else slipped away from there.
Slipped away?
Slipped right past us. I couldn't understand what he was getting at. Because the soul isn't something you can see, Menshiki said. You believe in the existence of the soul? Do you? I didn't have a good answer. I believe that it's not necessary to believe in the soul's existence. But turn that around, and you come to the belief that there's no need to not believe in its existence. A kind of roundabout way of putting it, but do you understand what I'm getting at?
Sort of, I said.
Menshiki picked up the bell from where I'd placed it in front of the shrine. He held it out and rang it several times. A priest probably breathed his last there, underground, ringing this bell and chanting sutras. All alone, shut away in the pitch-black darkness, that heavy lid in place, in the bottom of a sealed well. And most likely all in secret. I have no idea what sort of priest he was. A respectable priest or merely some fanatic. Either way, someone constructed a stone tumulus on top of it. I don't know what happened after that, but people then completely forgot he'd been voluntarily buried under here. Then a big earthquake occurred at some point, and the mound collapsed until it was just a pile of stones. It could have been during the Kanto earthquake of 1923, since certain areas around Odawara suffered real damage back then, and everything was swallowed up into oblivion. If that's true, then where did the priest who died there, the mummy, I mean, disappear to? Menshiki shook his head. I don't know. Maybe at some point, someone dug up the hole and took him away. To do that, they'd have to move all these stones and then pile them up again, I said. And then, who was ringing the bell yesterday in the middle of the night? Menshiki shook his head again, and smiled faintly. Good grief. We used all this equipment to move the stones and open up the chamber, and in the end, all we found out for sure is that we don't know a single thing. All we managed to get was an old bell. They examined the stone chamber thoroughly and merely determined that there were no hidden devices anywhere. This was merely a round hole, lined with a stone wall 8.2 feet deep with a diameter of 5.9 feet. They made precise measurements. Finally, they loaded the backhoe up onto the truck bed, and the workers collected all their tools and left. All that remained was the open hole and the metal ladder. The foreman was kind enough to leave it behind. They also laid several thick boards on top of the hole so no one would fall into it by mistake. They left some heavy stones on top to weigh the boards down so they wouldn't blow away in a strong wind. The wooden lattice cover was too heavy to lift, so they left it on the ground nearby and covered it with a plastic tarp. Before they left, Menshiki told the foreman not to mention this operation to anyone. It had archaeological significance, and he wanted, he said, to keep it from the public until the time was right to announce the find.
Understood, the foreman said with a serious expression. We'll leave it all here, and I'll warn the others not to say anything about it.
After the workers and heavy machinery had left, and the mountains were blanketed in their usual stillness again, the dug-up area looked like skin after a major operation, shabby and pitiful. The formerly vigorous clump of pampas grass had been trampled down beyond recognition, the ruts left by the backhoe like stitches left behind in the dark, damp soil. The rain had cleared up completely, though the sky was still covered by an unbroken layer of monotonously gray clouds. When I looked at the pile of stones now stacked up on another piece of ground, I couldn't help but think, we should never have done this. We should have left them the way they were. On the other hand, though, the indisputable fact was that it was something we had to do. I couldn't go on listening to that strange sound night after night. But if I hadn't met Menshiki, I never would have had the means to dig up that hole. It was only because he had arranged for the workers and had paid for the whole thing, I had no clue how much it cost, that the operation had been possible. But meeting Menshiki and, as a result, having this large-scale excavation take place, was it really all just coincidence? Had it all just fallen together by chance? Weren't things just a little too convenient? Hadn't the scenario been all planned out in advance? With all these unanswered doubts, I went with Menshiki to the house. He carried the bell we'd unearthed. He never let go of it the whole time we were walking, as if trying to read from the touch of it some kind of message. As soon as we got back inside, Menshiki asked, "Where should I put this bell?" Where, indeed, I had no idea. For the time being, I decided to place it in the studio. Having that weird object under the same roof didn't sit well with me, but that said, I couldn't just toss it outside. It was, no doubt, a valuable Buddhist implement, imbued with a certain soulfulness, so I couldn't just neglect it. I decided to put it in the sort of neutral zone of the studio, which felt like a separate annex. I cleared a space on the long, narrow shelf used for painting materials and placed it there. Next to the large mug used to hold brushes, it even looked like some specialized painting tool. "What a strange day," Menshiki said. "I'm sorry you had to use up your entire day for this," I said.
"No, don't apologize. It's been very interesting," Menshiki said. "And this isn't the end of it, I would imagine."
Menshiki had an odd look on his face, as if gazing far away. "Meaning something else is going to happen?" I asked. Menshiki chose his words carefully.
"I can't explain it well, but I get the feeling that this is only the beginning."
"Only the beginning?" He held his palms upward. "I'm not sure, of course. Maybe that'll be it, and we'll just be left thinking what a strange day that was. That would probably be the best outcome. But nothing's been resolved. The same questions remain. And these are very important questions. That's why I have a hunch that something else is going to happen."
"Something connected to that stone-lined chamber?"
Menshiki gazed outside for a moment before he spoke.
"I don't know what's going to happen. It's just a hunch."
And of course, it turned out as he'd felt, or predicted, it might. Like he said, that day was only the beginning.
Chapter 16. A Relatively Good Day. That night, I had trouble sleeping. I was anxious whether the bell I'd left in the studio would start ringing in the middle of the night. If it did, then what would I do? Pull the covers up over my head and pretend not to hear anything until the next morning?
or take my flashlight and go to the studio to check it out? And what would I find there? Unable to decide how I should react, I lay in bed reading. But even after 2 a.m., the bell hadn't rung. All I heard was the usual drone of insects. As I read my book, I checked the clock next to my bed every 5 minutes. When the digital display read 2:30, I finally breathed a sigh of relief. The bell wouldn't be ringing tonight, I figured. I closed the book, turned out the bedside light, and went to sleep. The next morning, when I woke up before 7, the first thing I did was go check on the bell. It was as I'd left it the night before, on the shelf. Brilliant sunlight illuminated the mountains, and the crows were in the midst of their usual noisy morning routine. In the light of day, the bell didn't look ominous at all. It was nothing more than a simple, well-used Buddhist implement from the past. I went back to the kitchen, brewed coffee in the coffee maker, and drank it. Heated up a scone that had gotten hard in the toaster, and ate it. Then went out to the terrace, breathed in the morning air, leaned against the railing, and looked over at Manshiki's house across the valley. The large tinted windows glistened in the morning sun. Probably one of the tasks included in the once-per-week cleaning service was to clean all the windows. The glass was always clean and shiny. I looked over there for a while, but Manshiki didn't appear. We still hadn't yet reached the point where we waved at each other across the valley. At 10:30, I drove my car to the supermarket to buy groceries. I came back, put them away, and made a simple lunch, a tofu and tomato salad with a rice ball. After I ate, I had some strong green tea. Then I lay down on the sofa and listened to a Schubert string quartet. It was a beautiful piece. According to the liner notes on the jacket, when it was first performed, there was quite a backlash among listeners who felt it was too radical. I don't know what part was radical, but something about it must have offended the old-fashioned people of that time. As one side of the record ended, I suddenly got very sleepy, so I pulled a blanket over me and slept for a while on the sofa. A short but deep sleep, probably about 20 minutes. It felt like I had a few dreams, but when I woke up, I couldn't remember them. Those kinds of dreams, the kind where all sorts of unrelated fragments are mixed together. Each fragment has a certain gravitas, but by intertwining, they canceled each other out. I went to the fridge and drank some cold mineral water straight from the bottle and managed to chase away the dregs of sleep that remained like scraps of clouds in the corners of my body. I felt a renewed awareness of the reality that I was living, alone, in the mountains. I lived here by myself. Some sort of fate had brought me to this special place. I remembered the bell. In the weird stone chamber deep in the woods, who in the world had been ringing that bell? And where on earth was that person now? By the time I had changed into my painting outfit, gone into the studio, and stood looking at Manshiki's portrait, it was past 2 p.m. Normally, I worked in the morning. From 8 to noon was the time I could focus best on painting. I liked the sort of domestic quiet at those times. After moving to the mountains, I'd grown fond of the brilliant and pure air that the teeming nature around me provided. Working at the same time in the same place each day has always held a special meaning for me. Repetition created a certain rhythm. But this day, partly because I hadn't slept well the night before, I spent the morning without accomplishing anything, which is why I went to the studio in the afternoon. I sat on my round work stool, arms folded, and from a distance of some 6 feet, gazed at the painting I'd begun. I'd started by using a thin brush to outline Manshiki's face, then, with him modeling before me for 15 minutes, also used black paint to flesh this out. This was just a rough framework at this point, though it gave rise to a productive flow, a flow that had its source in Wataru Menshiki. This was what I needed most. As I stared hard at this black and white framework, an image of a color, I should add, came to me. The idea sprang up suddenly, all on its own. The color was like that of a tree with its green leaves dully dyed by rain. I mixed several colors together and created what I wanted on my palette. After much trial and error, I finally arrived at what I'd pictured and, without really thinking, added the color to the line drawing I'd done. I had no idea myself what sort of painting would emerge from this, though I did know that that color was going to be a vital grounding for the work. Gradually, this painting was beginning to stray far afield from the format of a typical portrait. But even if it doesn't turn out as a portrait, I told myself, that was okay. As long as there was a set flow, all I could do was go with it. What I wanted now was to paint what I wanted to paint, the way I wanted to paint it, something Menshiki wanted as well. I could think about the next step later on. I was simply following ideas that sprang up naturally inside me with no plan or goal, like a child not watching his step, chasing some unusual butterfly fluttering across a field. After adding this color to the canvas, I set my palette and brush down, again sat down on the stool 6 feet away, and studied the painting straight on. This is indeed the right color, I decided. The kind of green found in a forest wet by the rain. I nodded several times to myself. This was the kind of feeling toward a painting I hadn't experienced for ages. Yes, this was it. This was the color I'd wanted. Or maybe the color the framework itself had been seeking. With this color as the base, I mixed some peripheral, variant colors, adding variation and depth to the painting. And as I gazed at the image I'd done, the next color leaped up at me. Orange. Not just a simple orange, but a flaming orange. A color that had both a strong vitality and also a premonition of decay. Like a fruit slowly rotting away. Creating this color was much more of a challenge than the green. It wasn't simply a color, but had to be connected with a specific emotion, an emotion entwined with fate, but in its own way firm, unfluctuating. Making a color like that was no easy task, of course, but in the end, I managed. I took out a new brush and ran it over the surface of the canvas. In places, I used a knife, too. Not thinking was the priority. I tried to turn off my mind, decisively adding this color to the composition. As I painted, details of reality almost totally vanished from my mind. The sound of the bell, that gaping stone tomb, my ex-wife sleeping with some other man, my married girlfriend, the art classes I taught, the future. I thought of none of it. I didn't even think of Menshiki. What I was painting had, of course, started out as his portrait, but by this point my mind was even clear of the thought of his face. Menshiki was nothing more than a starting point. What I was doing was painting for me, for my sake alone. I don't remember how much time passed. By the time I looked around, the room had gotten dim. The autumn sun had disappeared behind the western mountains, yet I was so engrossed in my work I'd forgotten to switch on a light. I looked at the canvas and saw 5 colors there already. Color on top of color, and more color on top of that. In one section, the colors were subtly mixed. In another part, one color overwhelmed another and prevailed over it. I turned on the ceiling light, sat down again on the stool, and looked at the painting. I knew the painting was incomplete.
There was a wild outburst to it, a type of violence that had propelled me forward, a wildness I had not seen in some time. But something was still missing, a core element to control and quell that raw throng, an idea.